There's a drive down the right field line into the corner, and it is gone! Home run, Vinny Pasquantino. 2-1 Royals.
Belted. Deep right field. Way back into the back of the Royals bullpen. That sounded like a cannon blast. And Pasquantino ties the game at one.
You'll notice two different people on the call there. That's because the Royals had a doubleheader yesterday, and Vinny Pasquantino homered in both of them. Steve Fisiak there on the first one, Ryan LaFever on the second one, as the Royals split their doubleheader with the White Sox on Tuesday afternoon and evening. Welcome into the Sports Ticket here on this Wednesday, August 10th on Katy Country 94, katycountry94.com. Glad to have you with us, Dusty Donis, along with Jason Broadfoot this morning here on Katy Country 94. Again, the Royals get the split with the White Sox. We'll have more on that coming up momentarily. Also, the Kansas City Chiefs, we went over their depth chart yesterday, and that's bound to change coming up today, as they've added another defensive tackle. I don't know if they've officially signed him yet, but the deal is in place for a new defensive tackle as well. We'll tell you about that. We'll have an update on where Deshaun Watson's suspension is at right now, and where everything sits there with the NFL. And we also can tell you about some LIV golfers that were trying to get into the FedEx Cup playoff, and they were denied by a judge yesterday. So you might have heard a little bit about that there at the top of the hour on our news here on Katy Country 94, but we'll maybe dive into that a little bit more as well coming up here on the Sports Ticket. Well, let's start first with Major League Baseball, and there are some other notes that we'll have after we talk about the Royals, and also we'll have our customary Cubs update coming up as well here later in the show. But we start first with the Royals, and again, they split their two games with the White Sox as they won 4-2 in Game 1. The White Sox took Game 2 3-2. White Sox had a 1-0 lead before Vinny Pasquantino hit that two-run home run heard earlier, the first one you heard, to put the Royals up 2-1. And then Nick Prado, the rookie, had a two-run home run of his own later on in the sixth inning to put the Royals up 4-1, and they would end up with the two-run win there. A great showing from Brady Singer. He got the win, improving to 5-4 on the season. He gave up just one run, five hits, six strikeouts, 7 1/3 innings. He went back out there for the eighth, and a couple got on. His pitch count was up to 99, so they took him out, and they were able to bring Barlow in and get out of the eighth. They did get one run, the White Sox did in the ninth, but again, Brady Singer was outstanding yet again, and he's continued to prove throughout this season, as the season goes on, that he is consistent with what he's doing on the mound, and you like to see that. He was a little bit better this time out than he was last time he pitched against the White Sox. Mike Matheny, the Royals manager, on Brady Singer.
Brady was obviously very good. I thought it was maybe his best sinker of the year. Just you see that many good hitters take ball to strike pitches that they're questioning, and you go back and you look, and it had movement that they're not accustomed to, and then he played off of it with the slider. Didn't use a change up much today, but those two were so good, and it was both sides of the plate, and just kind of letting the movement kind of do its thing, and at times starting it almost off the plate to get to the inside part. He had so much movement.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I've noticed when Brady's pitching is lately. I didn't watch the game. He gave up 11 hits against the White Sox last time they played, but he does seem to have more movement on his pitches, and he's also putting it where he wants to. Like, he is all around the plate and doing everything you need to do as a pitcher to have success, not getting these fat pitches right down the middle where where guys can just blast them out if it's a changeup or if it's a fastball 95 right down the heart of the plate, and Aaron Judge or somebody just blast it right out of the park. But I think that's one of the things that I've noticed maybe more than I've ever seen with him, is the fact that he does have a lot of movement to it, and he's also able to put it wherever he wants with that movement. And that's not an easy thing to do as a pitcher, to have the movement but also place that ball exactly where you want when you're done with that pitch.
Right. For you to know what that ball's going to do and not have the hitter know what the ball's going to do is a weird line there. That's you want to know where that ball's going to move and how it's going to move so you can adjust to where you want it. Like Matheny said, if you have to start it just a little bit off the plate and have it dive back in, to be able to do that on a consistent basis but still not have the hitters figure it out, it's tough to do. And so, you know, that's why you use the second, and now with Singer, the third pitch. You know, Matheny said the changeup he didn't use a whole lot today or yesterday, but if he can yeah, and he has been. You know, there was a rough start for a lot of the starting pitchers for the Royals, but he seems to have evened himself out. He seems to be the most consistent of the starters right now, along with Greinke. And, you know, we're talking about looking ahead. You know, I don't know exactly where that pencils in, if you want to call him a two or a three or whatever, but, you know, it can be a piece moving
a mainstay.
Forward. Yeah, a mainstay. I mean, and
you don't worry about him being part of that rotation anymore right now.
Yeah, yep, yeah. You don't have to hope that you're going to get 5-6 innings. You can pretty much start to count on it. And yeah. If you can do that, that's what makes major league teams successful. And hopefully Brady can continue to do that.
Game two, the Royals lost 3-2 to the White Sox. This was it was just a low-scoring game throughout. White Sox got a run, homer in the third inning from Sosa. Pascantino tied the game with another homer for himself in the fourth inning. He became the 13th player in franchise history to homer in both games of a doubleheader. So put that in your hat if you're Vinny Pascantino. Johan Moncada, though, spoiled the party of the solo homer in the for the White Sox in the sixth. They added an insurance run in the eighth. Nick Prado hit a sack fly in the ninth to get it back to 3-2, but going against Liam Hendricks, you don't really feel like you're probably going to come out on top in that, and they didn't. They did get one run in the ninth inning, but they Hendricks shut the door on them the rest of the way, and the White Sox got the 3-2 win as they improve. The Royals actually, with the split, they're now 45-66. The Royals are. The White Sox are 56-54. Jonathan Heasley had a decent start on the mound for the Royals. He took the loss in game two. He gave up just two runs on seven hits and five and a third innings. Falling to 1-7 on the season, Matheny commented on Jonathan Heasley and his performance on the mound.
Jonathan was much better than the last time we saw him. You could tell him he's a little more timed up. I thought he looked good. He had a couple breaking balls that rolled into the zone, the one cost him for a home run, but I thought he used his slider better, the curveball at times. Yeah, he got a couple good swing and misses on it, and his changeup's always a good pitch. But, I thought overall it was much better, but I thought it's a good outing. You're talking five and a third there, a couple runs, and gave us a chance.
There's Jonathan Heasley. There's, again, who Mike Matheny was talking about there. So Heasley's actually not been terrible, really, this year. Mm-hmm. There's been some bad outings. There's been some good outings. Last night was a decent one. Five and a third, you want your pitcher to go longer than that, but that seems to be something that people accept these days, so right. Five and a third is good enough. He did give up seven hits and had a walk, but struck out five. The two runs he gave up were both solo home runs, so just a couple mistakes, as you heard Matheny talking about there. Liam Hendricks' 23rd save, by the way, last night for the White Sox, but I guess you take what you can get from these pitchers. The offense didn't perform in the second game like they probably should have, and they fall 3-2, the Royals do. One thing I do want to talk about, and this is probably going to get old talking about this, but I do want to compare the lineups again, because there's part of this in a doubleheader that really somebody's got to explain to me why it makes sense. Like, some of the things that are happening here. Now, I understand, again, like we've established that if we want to get at-bats for guys – MJ Melendez is probably going to have to play in the outfield at times, and I get that. But I will say it's interesting that MJ Melendez at catcher has one of the best games he's ever had. Six RBI, he goes back into left field, not right field. Lead off at left field and goes 0-4 yesterday with two strikeouts. Yeah. And I don't know, maybe that's Lance Lynn. I don't think that's Lance Lynn, to be completely honest with you. I think he went back to a position that he's not familiar with, and I think probably had a little more pressure on him to perform at that position and try to learn that position again. And then he promptly started at catcher in the second game, but went 0-3, and his average is now down to 230. He did have a walk in the second game, which he did not have in the first game. But anyway, lineup for the Royals. Melendez was in left and leading off. So if you kind of just like go through the battery here and then and go on infield to outfield, Salvador Perez was a catcher in game one yesterday. First baseman was Nick Prado. He had Michael Massey again at second base. Again, we've established that the Royals want to play him at second if he's in the lineup, so he was at second base. Nicky Lopez at shortstop in the first game. Bobby Witt Jr. is at third in the first game. And then outfielders, as we mentioned, Melendez left field, Michael A. Taylor center field, Kyle Isbell started the game in right field. Pascantino was a DH in that first game. Melendez got taken out after the 0-for-4 start, and Nate Eaton came in, and he played right field, and then they moved Kyle Isbell to left field. And I'm like, I need to start Isbell on left. And then Nate Eaton could have just replaced MJ Melendez in right field. Yeah. You don't have to move people around. Yeah. That's one thing that I don't understand. And then I go to the second game, and I'm like, why are we – like, what's the – I just don't understand the thought process of moving guys around if you're going to move them to a different position for the second game. Now, I get you're not going to have Salvi catch in both games of a doubleheader. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that. I get it. So Melendez moved to catcher. I get that. DH was Perez. But now we want Nick Prado to still play. We want Pascantino to play. So we have to put Pascantino at first. We still want Prado out there. So let's put him in left. So they put Nick Prado in left field. Bobby Witt Jr. is back at shortstop. Nicky Lopez is playing second because we're not playing Michael Massey two games in a row, and Hunter Dozier's at third. And that's what I don't like about it. Like, you move one guy, be a utility infielder, right? And maybe that's Nicky Lopez in the future. Maybe that's, you know. But it's just a constant. Everybody's moving to different positions and in a doubleheader even. Like, today, you're going to play two different positions, and we're going to see how you can screw those up. And the reason I bring that up is because in the eighth inning last night, Nick Prado's playing left field, and the White Sox hit just a routine ball out there to left that normal left fielders are either going to stay in front of, or they're going to maybe have the wherewithal. They understood how it came off the bat. They might even be able to go catch it right out in the left field. Well, he plays it wrong, and it gets by him. And I don't think that a normal left fielder was even going to make the out. Right, it probably would have bounced. They would have been in the right position coming off the bat not to let it get into the corner and then get past you. Well, this thing gets past Nick Prado. I mean, there's a guy on first, I believe, and Luis Robert hits it. Sheets is the one that hit it. Luis Robert is on first base, I believe. And so the ball gets by Prado, and he's so slow to go get to it. And he doesn't know how to field the position. And his relay throw is even slower than getting to the ball.
Yeah.
And it's just like, these are the reasons that I don't like guys testing things out. And maybe Gordon looked like that when he started in left field in Omaha, right? Like, he was slow. He didn't know where to go to the ball. He didn't know the angles to take to get to the ball.
Yeah.
But it's just so embarrassing when you're seeing that at the big league level. And they're like, it's like, I don't know a lot about the game, right? Like, I know the basics about baseball, but I know that that does not look good.
No.
When a guy doesn't know how to field the position, and it looks embarrassing to me. But you do what you do, and you move on, I guess. So the left fielder, by the way, Nick Prado last night. Center field last night was Michael A. Taylor in game two, and Nate Eaton played right field. So, again, they mix it up. A lot of different guys playing a lot of different positions. And listen, I get the season is lost. Like, they're not playing for the playoffs. They're playing to develop guys. But I just still don't know how you develop people when they continually are changing positions. These are not not one single position do you have to go out and do the same things every day. So how do you develop consistency as a young player if you're continually playing different positions, and then now you got to hit too and bat, so and try to have the right focus at the plate when you are trying to learn two to maybe three different positions in the field, and that's the issue I have with it. It's not the fact that this one person I don't like is playing right field, because we've established that MJ Melendez is going to have to play in the outfield if he wants at bats based on who else is on the team. But it's just that continuous moving guys to different places all the time, and that's what's aggravating me right now.
Yep. We talked about this earlier. It's like, if you're going to do Melendez in the outfield right now for the rest of the season, I don't have a problem with that. But let's just keep him at one outfield position. Like, if you think it's going to be right field, then let's just keep it right field. Same with Prado. I know he's played a little bit all over, a little bit of left, a little bit of right, not a whole lot. But if you're going to do that, let's just keep it there or in the future. And he can learn those things about how the ball comes off a left-handed hitter's bat, when they slice it out there. I know, just every once in a while, somebody hits a cue ball shot out there and it's going to bounce funny or it's going to slice a little bit. And
yeah,
you're not used to that. It's just going to happen. But you're right. If you're going to do one extra position, let's just keep it to one extra position.
Yeah. It's like that play last night, it's like Prado, it makes like what maybe Robert's going to get to third.
Yeah.
But he gets first to home because you got a guy out there that doesn't know what he's doing yet. And it just, I don't know. And it's a close game. Like if it was a 5-1, 6-1 game at that point already, it doesn't matter. But there's just been situations where it's like, God,
devil's advocate. But if you play the devil's advocate and you play the other side, that kind of means somebody's got to go down, doesn't it? If you're, because they're kind of log jammed at corner, outfield, first base, DH, and catcher in there. So somebody's got to go, and you don't, Pascatino just hit two home runs. You don't want to do that. Prado. He's probably the more highly touted prospect of the two, and so I don't know if you want to do that. So it's a tough decision all around. Which way do you want to go with it? Do you want to?
Well, I mean, you don't need. I don't. We're playing all these rookies because you want to see what they can do. Mm-hmm. I get it, but
yeah.
I mean, Nate Eaton and Michael Massey, do they have to be on the big league squad now?
That's another thing for me.
Those are the guys that I would start with, not Vinny Pascatino and Nick Prado.
Out there? Yeah.
Because Nick Prado is clearly a future starter on this team. He's the future at first base is what he is.
Right.
And Vinny Pascatino, obviously, is a bat you want in your lineup here. I think what's going to end up happening with some of these guys is they might get put into a package if the Royals get really good, and we might have to part with one of these guys. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, again, there's one veteran that's taking a spot here that that could fix a lot of the problems.
Yep.
But, again, it's sacrilegious to say bad things about Salvador Perez with the Royals. So, it's something we'll talk about the rest of the season because that's really all there is to talk about with the Royals.
Yep.
What are they doing with their lineup? How are these guys developing? And that's what the biggest part of it for me is. It's not about the fact that I don't want this guy playing this position or this position. It's about development for me. And, like, I feel like you're stunting development if you don't have set positions for these guys. So you got to figure something out. And I know it's a tough job for Matheny because of the fact that there is a logjam at all these places and they want to get him at bats. But Michael Massey coming up has not helped this situation at all because he's only playing second base. So if he's in the lineup, then we're figuring is – are we better with Bobby Witt Jr. at third and Nicky at short, or are we better with Bobby Witt Jr. playing his position that he was supposed to be playing ever since Mondesi went out with the injury, or do we put Nicky at third or what? But Massey apparently clearly only plays one position, so that's made this whole thing worse than what it was, because now you've gone ahead and created another logjam by bringing Massey up. When does he need to be on the team right now?
Yep.
Listen, he... give them some big league at bats. I understand. I understand that part of it, of giving them a chance to see major league pitchers and getting at bats. But I just really think that, like I said with Melendez yesterday, your focus is like not the right. It's not right at the plate when you're continually being moved around, trying to learn positions and taking some of your brain power for what you're trying to do at the plate and moving it into the field. So I don't know. We'll move on. We'll figure it all out. But yesterday it was just weird to me that to see guys go out for a doubleheader and they're playing in all different positions. And I just wouldn't think that would be something you'd want to do. Now, some of these guys didn't play in the first game, like Dozier. So he has to get out there, and you got to find a spot for Dozier when he's in the lineup, too. So it's just it's a mess all the way around when you kind of look at how you're going to try to get consistency within this lineup, like I said, with all the log jams that they do have. The Royals, again, do split yesterday, though, with the White Sox. They'll move on. It's a four-game series in the end because they'll play tonight and tomorrow as well. Chris Bubich is on the mound tonight, 2-6 with a 5.27 ERA. We talked about pitchers that have about consistency and things like that. Bubich actually has been fairly consistently decent probably the last four or five times he's been on the mound. So that ERA was at like 9-something, and it's at 5.27 now. 2-6 record, though. He's starting for the Royals against Johnny Cueto. Cueto's on the mound tonight for the White Sox. He's 4-5, but has a 2.91 ERA this season for Chicago. Johnny Cueto, obviously, people around here remember, is part of the 2015 World Series championship team and picked up two really big wins in the postseason for the Royals there. Johnny Cueto gets a start here. First pitch, 7:10 tonight at the K between the Royals and White Sox. Some other baseball notes. Shohei Ohtani last night, he had another home run and another pitching win and another spot in the history books. The two-way sensation from Japan had an injury scare apparently last night. He pitched six scoreless innings and hit his team-leading 25th home run as well. He becomes only the second player in Major League Baseball history to have at least 10 home runs and 10 wins as a pitcher in the same season. And I think everybody knows who the other player was because there's not been another player really that's ever done anything like this, and that's Babe Ruth. So yeah. Shohei Ohtani, again, like I talked about the other day, not a once-in-a-generation player. He is a once-in-a-lifetime player. Yeah. And he's doing things that are wild to me and just continue to do it last night. The Angels did beat the Athletics 5-1 on Tuesday. So that's, again, he gets the win. Obviously, the Angels had to have won the game for him to get the win. And he does that. And the Angels are still terrible as far as their full record is concerned. Right. But Ohtani having another great season.
Now, I know he's kind of hanging around probably the Cy Young discussion. I don't know where you'd put him exactly right now, but I think he was in there. It'll be interesting to see if they let him continue to pitch into September because they're not going anywhere either. And if we think a normal positional player, it kind of wears down during a season and needs days off throughout the season to maybe only play 150 instead of 162. And then we think the same thing with starting pitchers. You only want to throw so many innings. He's doing them both. I mean, granted, a lot of it's DH, but
yeah, he's not really playing in the field.
But at the same time, you just don't see that very often. And maybe the Angels will save some of those innings for another day, but we'll see how it happens.
Yeah. I don't know if they will. I don't know if it's more taxing because he's actually trying to hit, but, I mean, you've seen National League pitchers do this their whole life, right?
Yeah.
Like pitch and hit, right? They don't necessarily try to hit very much.
Right.
So I don't know if that factors into anything as far as that's concerned, but, yeah, I don't know that they will. You can make the argument because their record's not good,
right?
And I get that,
right.
But at the same time, it's like I don't think Ohtani would want to.
He might not.
I don't think he'd want to do it that way either. And I think personally, if you want people to still come to your games,
yeah,
you should probably still have him pitch. And if he wants to do it, just let him do it. Because I don't think this. I think with what he does, your risk for injury is probably the same no matter what. I feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he's overly taxing himself based on who he is and what he's done his whole career so far, right? But, I mean, I get where you're coming from. But if I was going to predict, I would say they probably won't limit
just
him.
Just an idea.
It is, for sure, yeah. I'll be interested to see what happens with him from that aspect. Maybe they could shorten some of his starts. I would see him maybe doing that before just saying, no, you're not going to go out and pitch. Maybe put him on a pitch count and say, hey, don't go any further than this because we do want you for the future. Man, I wouldn't hate to be an actual Angels fan, though. Like, you got two of the most talented players, obviously, in this generation, and a couple that you could argue two of the most talented players that have ever played the game. And
you had some good years on the third one with Pujols, actually, too. You know, you had Trout, and granted, you didn't get a ton of Albert's prime years. You got a lot of the back end there, but that's still a name that resonates at the top of a lot of a name that's at the top of a lot of list of offensive categories. And we've mentioned it too. It's like, well, sometimes, okay, we have these stars and we're not going to try to sign anybody, but no, the Angels have tried to do things. CJ Wilson and Anthony Rendon and Andrew Haney and Syndergaard. And so they're trying to get other players, and it's just those guys don't work out the way they're supposed to either. And I don't know.
You make the playoffs is with the best record in the league and then get swept by the Royals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were not disappointed with that at all. The Angels fans were, for sure.
Sure.
It'll be interesting to see how that all plays out with Ohtani. But if I was going to predict, I'd say they'll probably keep pitching him and keep putting him out there for whatever he's supposed to do the rest of the year. Against Shohei Ohtani with 10 wins, 10 home runs, just the second player in Major League Baseball history to have that happen in the same season. Again, Babe Ruth was the last one to do it. Babe Ruth did it in 1918. I think that was his last year with the Red Sox, I believe. I think that's what they talk about. When they traded in 1918, and then after that, it was just all downhill from there for Boston and all the way until they broke the curse in 2004. So
ruined the country. Great Depression was right after that, too.
Yeah.
We had the Roaring Twenties, and then the Depression was in the 30s.
It came after that, It was after that.
So, yeah.
It's still, a little bit later than what you were maybe thinking, but
yeah.
I don't know if you saw this last night. Rodolfo Castro for the Pirates. He's flying around second base, sliding into third. All of a sudden, his phone comes flying out of his back pocket. And I'm like, pretty sure he's going to get fined. I don't think you're supposed to have your phones on your person in a Major League Baseball. They can't even wear smart watches, because I remember when Ned Yost got fined because he was wearing his watch. He didn't even realize it. He was like, it's a watch.
Right.
Like, what are we doing?
Yep.
And you can't have a smart watch, man.
You're not supposed to have any
digital
technology
like
in there.
It's like, don't cheat.
Yeah.
And he's coming sliding. This is what Castro said. He's like, I don't think there's any professional ball player that would ever go out there with any intentions of taking a cell phone. It's horrible what happened to me. Obviously, it was very unintentional. He said he was like putting his gloves in his pocket or pulling them out of his pocket, and he forgot about the phone in there. And I'm like, well, why was the? I don't understand why your phone was in your pocket anyway. Like, I don't even think you're supposed to have them in the dugout. So it's like,
these guys get dressed early. A lot of them get dressed early and go out and hit or they might at least have the pants on, so they go out and hit and maybe take fly balls or whatever they need to do. And so I'm going to halfway defend it, I guess, that maybe he had it in there from way early in the day and did forget. But part of me says,
he's just sitting around in the dugout and not feeling the phone in his back pocket the whole time. Right. It's the fourth inning when this happened, too.
Part of me says he's also like, I'm due up seventh this inning, so I'm going to go into the clubhouse and check my Twitter and Instagram and then, watching it on the TV or listening, and said, well, it's time to go. So he just stuffed it in his pocket. I think that's probably what happened. But yeah,
he's a call up. He's a rookie. But I'm guessing they have some of the similar rules in the minor leagues as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're all the same in the minors or not, but it's funny. Is he sliding in all of a sudden? This white thing starts flying out of his back pocket. And I'm like, what is going on here? So Rodolfo Castro, Could be having some money that he's going to have to give back to the major leagues because of, again, a call-up, so he doesn't have probably a great contract right now.
Right.
That could be a very costly mistake for Rodolfo Castro there for the Pirates, but yeah.
Probably be a kangaroo court fine from the team for doing something stupid. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a bad mistake in the end for Rodolfo Castro of the Pirates. All right, Cubs update with Jason Brock.
All right, we're doing this one from, of course, we have fantasy football coming up here. Your drafts might be scheduled. So Pete, Ruxin, Kevin, Jenny, Andre, and Taco, cast of the league, are bringing you this Cubs update today. That show was loosely based around Chicago, and Cubs lost 6-5. So that's what happens when you trade four people out of your bullpen. You take leads in the seventh inning and promptly give them up in the eighth. So, yeah, Nationals win 6-5, and the Cubs have, I believe it's 44-65 now.
Yeah. They're 21. That's the Royals are 21 under. Is it the same record? 45-66 is the Royals record. So one more win and one more loss.
Play so many games in a day. Yeah. So, I mean, they're going to be ahead.
Yeah. So, there's that. Cubs update, as we do every day here on the Sports Ticket. All right. We'll move on to football. And we talked a lot about the Chiefs depth chart yesterday. Again, that could very well change a little bit at the defensive tackle position. On Tuesday, the Chiefs signed free agent defensive tackle Danny Shelton. He was the 12th pick overall in the 2015 draft by the Browns. He's signing a one-year deal with the Chiefs. In his seven-year career, he's played for the Browns, Patriots, Lions, and Giants. He has 72 starts, 100 games played, 278 total tackles, 17 for loss in his career. And last year with the Giants, he had 31 tackles in 13 games in a backup role. So Danny Shelton, again, coming to the Chiefs. The biggest reason that they've signed him is to be another run stopper is what it sounds like. He's not a guy that's got a lot of sacks. He only has 6 sacks in his entire career, so he's not one of those guys that kind of is going to get that bull rush type of attitude that Chris Jones has and doesn't play that way. His best season was his first 3 years were not bad. He started all 3 years with the Browns after being the number 12 pick in the draft in 2015. Had 59 tackles in 2016, a sack and a half, 2 tackles for loss. The most tackles he's had in a single season was in 2019 with the Patriots. He had 61 combined tackles, 3 sacks, and 2 tackles for loss. So that was his best year. He started 14 out of 16 games for the Patriots in 2019. And so that you can see there's obviously some potential there. I don't know how that plays out. Again, he started 12 games with the Lions then in 2020, but played in 13 and didn't start any with the Giants last year. And I don't know if that was just the Giants system was not built for him to be a starter in it or what. But I think if you're looking for a run stopper and if he can maybe rejuvenate himself a little bit here after 31 tackles and a tackle for loss last year, maybe he can, provide something. I think if you're on a defense that has more around you, you could maybe be better as well and flourish and get a lot more chances. And I think Chris Jones could provide him that opportunity at the other defensive tackle spot. So,
and these are
that's a good signing. I don't know how much. I've not seen how much he's getting. It's probably going to be a very incentive based contract and a low amount of money, just like the Chiefs tend to do, like they did with Carlos Dunlap, and probably will do the same thing here with this defensive tackle.
Yep. One of those guys. These are the types of guys that the Chiefs are going to sign for the next few weeks. Guys that have been around a little bit and, kind of on the fringe of other teams' rosters, or maybe misfits from other teams' rosters that don't fit a system. But, no risk in that one, so why not? Let's give it a shot.
6'2", 345 pounds.
Yeah.
You look at this guy. He is a Samoan. There's no question about that. Has tribal tattoos on his arm. And I'm like, this looks like a bad dude here. Like, I think I can get down with that. And you can tell why he's not a pass-rushing defensive tackle at 6'2", 345, right? He might be able to move, but he's probably not going to move all that great.
And if you have smallish quicker linebackers, as the Chiefs kind of do. Maybe you need that big guy anchor in the middle, and that for a few plays a game. That's what Danny Shelton will hopefully do.
He is a unit. There's no doubt about that. Danny Shelton signed with the Chiefs. It's a one-year contract. Again, I haven't been able to find the numbers. I doubt it's on SpotTrack yet. I'll check real quick to see. I kind of am interested to see what they are paying him if it shows up. They've got the Giants contract on there from last year. So not on there yet. He was an unrestricted free agent, so we'll find out how much the Chiefs are paying him, most likely a little bit closer to when he actually does sign with the Chiefs, because I don't think he signed on the dotted line yet. He's just agreed to the one-year contract at this point in time, and he should be coming to camp fairly soon for the Chiefs. All right. Also in the NFL, as we expected, the NFL, well, they already did this last week. They appealed the 6-game suspension for Deshaun Watson. The NFL is wanting they want an indefinite suspension of no less than a year. Roger Goodell yesterday kind of talked about that, and he gave his reasoning why the NFL is kind of looking for more as far as the suspension is concerned for Deshaun Watson.
Well, as you know, it's part of the CBA. The two parties had that right. Either party could certainly challenge and appeal that, and that was something that we thought was our right to do, as well as the NFLPA's, and we decided it was the right thing to do.
Why go back to seeking the full year suspension?
Because we've seen the evidence. She was very clear about the evidence. She reinforced the evidence that there was multiple violations here, and they were egregious, and it was predatory behavior. Those are things that we felt, we always felt were really important for us to address in a way that's responsible.
Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, there sounds like you're about to fall asleep. Like, what are we doing, man? Putting me to sleep almost. I'm like, can I take a nap while you're talking here, Rog? Roger Goodell, again, as you heard, is saying that the league is seeking a tougher penalty because of numerous occasions of egregious and predatory behavior. And listen, I don't think that that's not anything we didn't know, right? Like, the, obviously, if you've settled out of 23 cases, there were numerous occasions of what happened here, egregious and predatory behavior. Again, the part where you're getting stuck on this whole thing will be the fact that there were no criminal charges.
Yep.
And this is all based on a personal conduct policy that the NFL has, and you have to interpret it. And again, Sue L. Robinson interpreted what the precedent was that had been set for some of these kind of things in the past, and her interpretation of what the NFL has done in the past was a 6-game suspension for Deshaun Watson. And so I initially was kind of like, I don't think the NFL is going to contest that, because they're the ones that put her in charge. The CBA, they wanted somebody new to do this. They didn't want Roger Goodell to be the end-all be-all every time something came up. And so it's like, well, I think maybe they should trust their process that they put in place for these individual occasions, and they don't trust the process right now. They want more, and they say it's warranted a 4-year suspension. I don't think I disagree with what Roger Goodell is saying.
I don't think
a lot of people would disagree with that it would warrant a 4-year suspension. But at the same time, it's like, what are you doing with some of these other guys that are getting 4 years that shouldn't, or some of these other suspensions where you feel should have been more that weren't?
Here's my issue with this particular case. We can talk about other cases, but whatever. But they're asking for an indefinite suspension. Like, that's what they're asking. They want an indefinite suspension for at least a year. To me, that seems to be part of the problem. Like, if you want a year, just ask for a year. And I think you have a better chance of getting that, or getting something closer to that. When you start asking for an indefinite suspension, that brings all that uncertainty into something, and you're going to get no help from the other side, because they're like, well, indefinite could mean 2 years, it could mean 3 years, whatever. So if you want a year, just say you want a year.
Yeah, I think the indefinite part would be, it's indefinite for us, but you need to decide what it is.
Yeah.
Right? If it's that, I think that's why they add in the language that says minimum 1 year. Mm-hmm. So if they deem that it should only be a year, well, they're fine with that. Indefinite means he's suspended right now at this moment.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure it out. You guys figure out how long that is, but it needs to be at least a year. Yeah. That's the way I interpret that anyway, is that once they tell me the suspension is a year and 3 games, then that's what the suspension is. Mm-hmm. I don't need it indefinite after that if I've actually gotten the number from you of what you feel it should be, but it needs to be at least a year. And I think that's probably the language for that is indefinite is for this year because we don't want him playing at all this year and then figure out what you're going to do after that. That's the way I interpret it anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that's just, they just don't want him on the field this year.
Yeah. They shouldn't. And you know, in my opinion, he probably shouldn't, you know. So, but, you know, let's, and here, but here's the problem. I, you know, not that I have a bunch of sympathy for the Browns, but I have empathy for the Browns in that if I'm an organization, I want to know what's going on as my preseason starts. You right? Is that too much to ask? You know, I want to know where my starting quarterback.
There's a little bit of wiggle because he does have no matter what a 6-game suspension. So you know he's not playing the first 6 games of the year, no matter what happens with the proceedings of the appeal here. So they have some wiggle room on that, and they understand that for at least six weeks of the season, they're either going to go with Jacoby Brissett or they're going to find some other quarterback that's going to play for him.
And so that's a difference. Like I can get by. Or I think in my head I can get
well,
by.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying, though, is like this will be figured out by that time.
Well,
I highly doubt that after the 6 games would be up that this is still a question on the appeal, right? Yeah.
But here's my question. It's like, say the 49ers cut Jimmy Garoppolo today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the Browns. What do I do? Do I go ahead and sign Jimmy Garoppolo because I think maybe Roger Goodell might get his way and this might be 10, 12, 14, even 17, a full season's worth of games? Or do I just stand pat with Jacoby Brissett because I think I can get by with 6 games? Because if Jimmy G gets cut today, you know, hypothetical, or another quarterback that you're interested in gets cut today or all of a sudden says, I want traded, I want to make a move. You know, I want my full information to decide on what is happening. I don't have any, you know, like I said, it's a fine line between empathy and sympathy there, but I want to know. I want to know what I can do and what I should be able to do and what I can't do. And this isn't stuff that popped up yesterday. I get it, you know. If somebody acted up, if all this started yesterday, I get that you're not going to know full information. But this isn't something that started yesterday. This is something that started 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, and that's why you don't have sympathy for the Browns, because they knew this was coming.
Right.
They knew that there was going to be an issue.
Yeah, I don't have sympathy about the draft picks or anything, but I want – but I – like just any organization with any suspension, you just want to know. Mm-hmm. You just want to know.
And if I was the Browns, honestly, because I'm like a lot of what they're going to do will have to do with what they have room for. Like,
right,
do they
right.
have room for Jimmy G? They have $47 million in cap space right now. So if you don't think – that Deshaun Watson's going to play and Jimmy G gets cut tomorrow, Jimmy G's not going to cost $47
million. Right.
So just sign him. Like, if I was doing that, because you already have some built-in protection if Deshaun Watson doesn't play.
Mm-hmm.
You've done, and you've made this first-year contract very low because of the fact that he may not play.
Right.
And so you have wiggle space in cap room, and if Jimmy G really wants to play and he would want to start, you could probably get him to sign a one-year deal and just play football, right? If the 49ers would cut him. Now, I don't think the 49ers are going to cut him.
I don't think
the 49ers are going to try to trade him, right?
Yeah.
I think they would try to trade him. And if Trey Lance wins the job, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to get what you would want for Jimmy G.
But see, there's another – with the $47 million, you can do that.
They can do it.
Jimmy G's like 25.
If you're worried and have empathy for the Browns, you can understand here they've got room if they really want to sign Jimmy G. If they need a quarterback to bring – and that's probably – they've probably done that on purpose, to be completely honest with you, because they knew it was – maybe possibly.
And it's not just the Browns. I'm just talking about any type, you know, if I was the Falcons, I would want to know, like, the Calvin Ridley thing was cut and dry and done in you know, a matter of days, right? Or that we know of.
Yeah.
So the Falcons got, you know, at least they, you know, they're not happy with the situation, but at least they knew. At least, okay, well, at least we know what we're up against.
Yeah.
You know.
The Browns, I guess, like, we're talking about the Browns because this is a specific situation.
Yeah.
And that's all we really need to talk about on this situation, is because the Browns are the only ones affected. And no matter what team it is, it's going to have a lot to do with what kind of cap space you have. Yeah. And it's going to have to do with the way you set it up, too. Mm-hmm. So I think it's clearly, like, if you're trading for a guy like this, no matter what the team is, and you're going to understand that there's a possibility he's not playing at all this year. And so you prepare for that possibility, right? And I think that's what the Browns have done with their cap. And obviously that's what they did with the contract. So I think no matter what the team would be, like, hopefully they would have done their due diligence, whether it's the Falcons with Ridley, that they understood the situation probably there too, probably had a backup plan in place if something happened to where he is suspended for the whole year, and he was. And so, I mean, I get where you're coming from. You want to know, but at the same time, you kind of know going in. Like, you know that there's a possibility here that he's not playing at all this year. And that's why you do that. That's why you leave $47 million in cap space and don't pay him very much in year one, right?
Yeah. And that's why I don't have complete sympathy.
Because I have zero sympathy.
The Browns knew what they were getting. You know, tossed everything at Deshaun Watson in Watson's favor. And if it doesn't work out, I'm not going to cry a single tear for the Browns. But if you take the team name away, I just have empathy for the situation, for the organization, for a organization. I would like to see the NFL just get this figured out, and, you know, so that way.
Everybody
knows what the deal is.
I know they've expedited all this, so I really don't think by the time the season starts that this will still be up in the air.
I hope
like
not.
They'll probably have it all figured out by that point. So, but again, even if they don't, it's six games at least. So if you feel like you should pay Jimmy G that much money for six games, or it might be 17, who knows? Yeah. So, but I don't know. I don't know that I'd feel overly confident with Jacoby Brissett going out there every time if I wanted to make the playoffs and actually have a good season. But we'll keep track of this, but obviously the NFL wants more, and that's what you heard from Roger Goodell there, and that he feels like the evidence is there to suspend Deshaun Watson for the full season. And you know, I'm not going to get too deep into the rest of that, because I again, what I said last week, I feel like he's probably paid part of the price already for missing an entire season already. And we can sit here and say, well, he wouldn't have played for the Texans either. Well, yeah, but if the Texans, you think the Texans would have traded him and somebody would have let him play last year if he got traded last year? So, I mean, it was a mutual decision. But Deshaun Watson wasn't going to play last year no matter where he was at. Like, they weren't going to let him. Like, he wouldn't have played. So, I feel like the league and the Browns or the Texans, I mean, have already suspended him for a year. So, that's why I'm trying to kind of take that part into consideration as well. And I wouldn't doubt if Sue Robinson took that part into consideration as well, saying he's missed an entire year already. Does anybody know that? Does anybody care about that? Or do I need to just go forward with what we are doing right now? So I don't know what all went in. I don't have the whole document that she went over and submitted or whatever. So I don't think anybody publicly does. So, but Roger Goodell feels like there's evidence there to have Deshaun Watson suspended for the rest of, or for the full 2022 football season. All right, we end the show with this. A federal judge on Tuesday denied temporary restraining orders for three golfers who were seeking to participate in the FedEx Cup playoffs after leaving the PGA Tour for the Upstart Live Golf Invitational Series. Taylor Gooch, Matt Jones, Hudson Swafford are the three players that were trying to get into the FedEx Cup playoffs, and they were trying to get a restraining order to let them play in the FedEx St. Jude Championship coming up this weekend. The top 125 players FedEx Cup standings are eligible to compete in the playoffs, and Gooch is 20th in the standings, Jones 65th, Swafford 67th. PGA Commissioner Jay Monahan suspended the players after they appeared in LIV golf tournaments. We know all that, the whole backstory on everything there. If you participated in LIV, you cannot participate right now. You're suspended from the PGA Tour. And it's wild to me that they even tried to do this. Like, I don't understand, like, where the precedent would be where you could actually try to get this done. But the U.S. District Court Judge Beth Labson Freeman of Northern District of California said, no, I don't buy it. Live players had not made their case of irreparable harm and agreed with the tour's position that the players' argument for emergency relief was of their own making, quote unquote. It appears that to the court that the live contracts negotiated by the players and consummated between the parties were based upon the players' calculation of what they would be leaving behind and the amount the players would need to monetize to compensate for those losses. I do agree with the defendants, the PGA Tour, that those losses were well known to the players at the time and clearly monetized. And I think that's a big thing. So they're like saying, oh, we got to get in this so we can get our money. Well, you got your money by going to live. And, yeah. And the only way that this is would have even been possible, I feel like, is if the full lawsuit from the live players against the PGA Tour has been settled and they ruled in favor of live, then now, yeah, you can go mm-hmm. back now because you're being shut out by the PGA Tour. We recognize that. We don't think that's right. It's antitrust laws and everything like that. You should be able to play with what you want. Mm-hmm. But at this point in time, that's not been settled. So I don't think any judge in the world would be like, oh, yeah, you can play. We're going to grant a restraining order and let you play. So there would have been a quick appeal for that, too. And I think they just didn't want the whole rigmarole of everything going, and obviously it's clear that they're not losing money by playing in live compared to PGA. They're probably making money.
Yep. And I also find it kind of funny that those are three, probably second, third tier PGA golfers. They're probably fringe live golfers. So when a bigger name comes along, these are probably the guys that get kicked out of those live tournaments. And so I just think you made your bed. You like, as a person, I agree with. I like this decision. Like, don't let them back in. They made their decision. Tough. In the long term, we'll see how that full lawsuit comes out. I still think the idea that you can play in the senior tour or the European tour, and then come back and play in the normal PGA Tour is probably going to hurt that case long term, but like this judge says, I'm not going to do anything for that long term case for a temporary restraining order for these three guys right now. I don't think there's any harm being done to them financially, so we'll see where that long term lawsuit falls. But as a person, I'm like, good, you don't get to come back.
These guys are not like top level guys that are making a lot of money in the PGA Tour, right? So it's like, based it on what you probably would have made and what you have made, it comes out in the wash, as they would say, but it also comes out a little bit better for you.
Sure.
All right, so that's what we have there. You can go there. A couple just real quick notes. This happened actually on Saturday, and I saw one of my friends on Facebook post it, but if Kansas is out of the Little League World Series running. The Little League World Series regional tournaments are going on in the USA right now. I think the actual Little League World Series starts on the 17th of this month. But I did want to say a note about the Kansas story because there's a local tie to it. Again, this happened on Saturday. Pittsburgh, Kansas, 12-under pitcher Gabe Brown threw a no-hitter Saturday afternoon in the team's 7-0 win over Kearney, Nebraska in the Little League Midwest Regional Tournament in Indianapolis. He threw 82 pitches in the game and collected 8 strikeouts. I saw where he had an RBI single in the game as well. Gabe Brown is the son of Matt Brown, a St. John's graduate back in the 90s. Off the top of my head, I don't have the year he graduated, but I know he was part of the team that was a state runner-up back in the 90s in 8-man football. Matt Brown's kid. So congratulations to him. Again, Kansas went 1-2 in the regionals, so they're done. They lost to Iowa, I believe it was yesterday, to finish that out. So, but it's saw that Adam posted that on Facebook. Thought it was a cool local tie-in story that I wanted to kind of put out there for people to hear and see as well. And Pittsburgh, Kansas was a representative for Kansas there in that regional tournament. Again, they did pick up the win over Nebraska, but they did lose 2, and they have been eliminated from a chance to play in the big Little League World Series, the actual Little League World Series in Pennsylvania coming up. Again, that starts a week from today, based on what I have seen. I believe it's the 17th of August where the actual Little League World Series will begin. So cool local story there. Also from the Little League World Series, or that or regional play of the World Series. The Little League World Series, by the way, is the 17th or the 28th. So that'll roll here coming up again next week. And, yeah, they'll get it going at the Little League World Series, South Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where they play those games. One other thing from Little League, check out my Twitter page, at Dusty40, and you can see the video, but it was kind of a touching thing yesterday in the Little League Regional. And I got to look at what regional this was, because the Kansas team's in the Midwest, so... I would guess it'd be the Southwest region in Waco, where Texas ended up winning, I believe, the whole tournament. Or actually, Oklahoma. Yeah, Texas won 9-4 over Oklahoma. But in that Oklahoma-Texas final yesterday, there was a youngster that got hit by a pitch right up in the face, in the head. And he went down. It actually kind of caught him underneath the ear flap. And I don't know if it grazed his chin or not. But it is obviously a fast pitch that came in high and inside. Texas was up by a run at the time, so they're not purposely hitting a guy to put him on the plate or anything like that, which probably rarely happens in Little League anyway. They're Little Leaguers. Pitches can get out of control. They can get out of your hands. But this particular Texas pitcher hit the Oklahoma kid near the head and in the face, and the Oklahoma batter dropped to the ground real quick ended up being okay, walked down to first base, and he looked at the pitcher's mound, and you could see the Texas pitcher just visibly upset, right? And the Oklahoma kid was at first base trying to get his attention, trying to holler at him, say, hey, hey, hey. He didn't have his helmet back on. He just tossed his helmet to the side, walked up to the pitcher's mound, and gave this Texas pitcher a hug, and obviously said something into his ear, said, you know, dude, you're doing just great, and you're all right, and this and this. And I thought, you know, of all the stories that we hear in youth sports, with whether it be parents yelling at officials or even the kids just going crazy with officials or coaches or whatever it is, there's so many bad stories that you see in youth sports, like so much negative publicity that they get, right? And I've been around some of it basketball-wise. I've never really been around, like, any traveling baseball or anything like that. But, you know, I've been to some tournaments where my nephew played basketball, and it gets pretty heated sometimes. Players don't like things. Players can take on a mentality of a coach and just be a whole team of people that want to scream and yell because they think the world's against them and things like that. But we need, in youth sports, we need to see more of these. I think these things happen, but they don't get shared like those outlandish stories do, because we want drama and we want entertainment, right? It's what we crave when we see something on Twitter or Facebook or hear it on the news or watch it on the news or whatever. But I think youth sports just needs more of what we saw yesterday with this Oklahoma kid. So, yeah, he hit me in the head, but I'm fine. You're going to be all right. You can move on and continue to pitch, because I'm great. I'm fine. I'm going to go back to first. But just to actually go up there and leave first base, go over, give him a hug, and say, hey, it's all right. I'm good. You're good. Let's play, is something that we definitely need a little bit more of. I can't explain it just with words without you actually seeing it. So, again, you can probably search Oklahoma, Texas Little League somewhere. Again, on my Twitter page, at Dusty40, I made a comment. You can see the video there. Just a great, great thing there as far as sportsmanship was concerned that I kind of wanted to share, along with the fact that we had a local tie-in there pitching for Kansas in the Little League Regionals that pitched a no-hitter over the weekend. So check that out again. It's on my Twitter page, at Dusty40. Otherwise, that'll wrap it up for the sports ticket today. And have a great day, everybody.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.